Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Welcome to Pixel Sift. It's Perth's own weekly video game podcast. Each week, we traverse the video game universe and some of the own of our own country, actually. We do traverse across this country to get you the topics that matter to you. I'm Gianni. This is our 11th episode, and we are streaming live on Twitch at twitch.tv/pixelsift from the extremely prestigious and extremely high quality house of old Scotty Quigg.
The house of Quigg.
The house of Quigg. We're in the house of Quigg right now. This week we're talking about...
Take from that what you will.
Yeah.
This week we're talking about fan expectations and post-release support.
Yes, that's right, Gianni. We'll be touching on the controversy surrounding Pro Evolution Soccer 2016 and their outdated roster systems, as well as other disappointing releases where our expectations weren't really met.
Yeah, we also have an interview with Trent Custers from League of Geeks. Gianni, you spoke to him about their game Armello.
Yep, and it's something that they've been focusing on very heavily. They've been making sure that they are trying to meet the expectations of a large group of fans that they have got in through their crowdfunding campaign and going from there. That's what we've got on the show today. All that and more coming up on Pixel Sift.
Oh, yeah, all that and more on Pixel Sift.
Sorry, stealing your
lines.
That's
okay. No worries. I'm just going to go to this.
You're listening to Pixel Sift. That's right. You're listening to Pixel Sift. We are a weekly video games podcast, and we are available on all the sources that you would, I guess, usually find podcasts.
Yeah, all the usual delivery systems.
You can get on there, find everything on there. This week, I had the distinct pleasure of visiting the Arcade in Melbourne. It's a gaming co-working space that is home to some of Victoria's gaming devs. And one of the big successes of this scene are those lovely folks at League of Geeks. And in a two-part interview this week, we chatted about their debut game. I spoke to one of the founders of League of Geeks, and he told me what it was all about.
Armello is a digital board game. Sort of, I guess you can imagine Game of Thrones meets Kung Fu Panda as a tabletop game brought to life. And that's what you've got. And throw in a bit of Studio Ghibli, some Miyazaki in there as well, and add that charm, and there you are, there you have it. So my name's Trent Custers, and I am one of the co-founders and directors of League of Geeks. And we made Armello.
So why did you go the digital board game format when we've got a bit of a renaissance of physical board games?
Well, it goes hand in hand, really. As the renaissance of physical board games is coming about, there was also the release of the iPad, what, 6 or 7 years ago. And that's when we founded Armello 5 years ago. And we were playing games on our iPad, and we're all tabletop gamers playing, you know, these fantastic tabletop games that were coming out as the renaissance was kicking off. And we were also playing them on our iPad, and they were just pathetic, really. They were insultingly bad. As both as tabletop gamers and as video game developers, we knew we could do better, and that the format and that the medium, this new genre of digital tabletop games, deserved better. And so we were like, well, we want to make a game, we want to collaborate together. There's no better way to do it. We know the medium, and we know how to make games within the medium, so let's do it. Let's just double down on this.
So what can you do with a digital board game that you can't do with a physical board game that hasn't released?
The main one is obfuscation of mechanics and systems and game state, really, which is funny because that's, you know, where some of the criticism has come in about the game, but that's where we explore a lot of it. So the perfect example is stealth. In a tabletop game, you have a character on the board and there's stealth, but for me to actually see them, I need to roll my dice and blah, blah, blah. But they're there. I know where they are on the board. And obviously, even on some subconscious level, that creates a bias and that factors into my decisions within the game. But with Armello, you just can't see the character. In fact, we made more changes to the game today to obfuscate more things when a character is in stealth. So there's a bunch of that stuff. And then just the basic presentation things, you know, this is what video games do. Board games work largely on abstraction, you know, from the knights, these beautiful regal horses busts in chess. You know, that's meant to be a knight on horseback, basically. That's what it's... But we deal in abstraction a lot in tabletop games. And what video games does, or what it provides you, is we can actually bridge that gap further. We can make things more literal. We can remove or reduce the amount of abstraction needed. So instead of having these little colored pips that you're moving around the board, we have fully animated characters that move around the board and, you know, attack and growl and you know, do their boast animation and are living, breathing entities for all intents and purposes. And so that presentation level is huge. For example, when we brought it onto the digital platform, that was one of the first things that we figured out. It's like, okay, can we make seamless tiles and can we have clouds and how many in the game and how many characters can we have on the screen at any one time, and let's get them animating. And you know, we had birds in the game before we had our quest system.
Did you have to do it physically in pieces of paper? And
yeah, we prototyped our Mallow on paper for about 8 months before we actually touched a line of code. And so that was when we were working out of hours, when we were first getting things off the ground, and we were designing the profit share point system in the background. And so while we were doing that, we were coming together every week and having like meetings, design meetings, business meetings, you know, the company meetings. And we would also play test the latest prototype. And so it started off, Blake just brought one in, and it was just like ruled up satellite imagery that he printed off onto a big piece of paper. And then he wrote up some units on pieces of paper, and we played like this little war game. And then it was like, okay, we'd stop, you know, sort of halfway through or at the end of a game, and we have a big design debrief. What did we like? What didn't we like? What does it need to feel more like? What can we leverage better on digital platforms, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of that, we'd obviously have a bit of a bunch of things that we want to change, and then someone different would put their hand up to implement those changes. And so, you know, then Ty would take it the next week, and then I would take it the next week. So that's why you've got this game that's sort of this hybrid mix of tactical, like hex-based battle, you know, that you would see in something like a Memoir 44, and then you've got this amazing like card play, and then you've got this deep narrative dynamic quest system and the character role playing, because those sort of three things are Blake, Ty, and my interests, right? So there was that tug of war in equal directions that brought that.
A big part of playing board games is playing with other people.
Yep.
And was there, when you had to make the decision to not have any, I guess there's no local multiplayer in the actual game.
Yeah.
And was that a design decision versus, you know, you'd give up some of your obfuscation of stealth and things like that by having everyone in the same room?
Yeah, we knew there was talk of hot seat or pass the pad, because we were originally aiming the game at iPad. And so we had spoken about pass the pad at an early stage, but very much from almost day one, it was going to be a game that was you play on your own device, whether it be an iPad or a PC, and you play with people on their multiplayer with the connected devices, so they have their own device. Because we knew that we wanted to, one of the biggest parts about being a digital board game is that we're here as one of the first people or studios to work in this genre, to explore this genre. We had to experiment with obfuscation of game state. And so that was a big thing for us. And we knew that if everyone could just see what was happening on the same screen, then so much of that intrigue and the backstabbing and all of that that comes with Armello and that political side of things, the Game of Thrones part of our game, that just wouldn't be there. It wouldn't have survived that hot seat environment. Because a lot of Armello's really information is power. And so, and we lean into that a lot.
One of the things when I was playing the game is I noticed there's a big element of the randomization of rules, very similar to like Final Fantasy Tactics, where you have the judges kind of playing all these different rules to mix it up. Is there an advantage in having a digital board game that you can release expansions and go, well, we're going to put a, you know, a weekly rule set or something like that?
Yeah, totally. So we've just added in V1.1, which is our first major update. So our Mellow is being continually updated, just as if we were in early access, even though the game's seen a full release, and we're continuing to support it with free major content drops. And our most recent one, V1.1, Armelian's Roar, added house rules. So now you can actually just go through and change a bunch of features. And no doubt when we do our next update, V1.2, that will have new house rules. And we can just push, this is the beauty of digital platform, is that we can just, if the community says they want something, there's no manufacturing, you know, time where things have to get sent off to a factory, you don't have to order it or leave your house or anything like that. It's just boom, it's right there. And we can just throw it in the game. So yeah, there is a lot of cool stuff, and of course, you know, we can just tweak little things and experiment, fool around with different gameplay modes. It's great.
And are there any mechanics that you would just, I guess, retire in a future patch, or would you get to a point where you're thinking, well, this isn't working exactly how I want it to, and maybe we'll remove that and going into future, or?
Yeah, totally. We've done that a bunch of times all the way through early access. We pulled a bunch of systems, and we'll do it moving on. Like, nothing's sacred in the game, really. Of course, the goal is to make the game as good as it can be, and a lot of the time in game development, that means cutting things, you know. And so if something has to go, lest it, you know, be one of our favorite features, it'll go if it makes the game better, if it makes the experience better for the community, for sure.
That was Trent Custers of League of Geeks. We'll be back with Trent a little bit later in the show.
Pixel Sieve!
It's not Pixel Sieve, it's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sieve!
So, today we'll be discussing games that have kind of let us down after they've been released with their backup support and trouble support and everything. This has come off the back of Pro Evolution Soccer 16, which is the secondary, the backup, the underdog to FIFA, and it has been for a long time. They finally released a really, really great game, but it's been out for 4 months now, and they still haven't got up-to-date rosters for all the teams. Which is, as far as sports games go, for people that are really immersed in that kind of the gaming of sports, it's a big deal.
All right, so run me through exactly what happened there.
So basically, the game was released 4 months ago.
Okay.
Passed a transfer window, mm-hmm. And they still didn't kind of update to that date. Like, they released after the transfer list had closed, the transfer window had closed.
I see.
And they still didn't keep it up to date. And still 4 months later now, they've only released one update. And it wasn't a full update. They promised one for next week. And on top of that, that's just for console issues. And on top of that, PC have had extra issues with just general problems with the game.
So this is like the transfer list is the list of real life players, the players, you know, that have moved
so
between
like,
teams.
Exactly
like that.
So okay. You might have some wicked player that's just been signed to the team that you support and want to play with, but uh-huh. You can't because they're still playing for their old team because they're out of date.
And the support just hasn't been there.
Yeah, not at all.
Right.
And there's been a huge complaint about it. It's been, you know, a hugely covered issue, and just nothing's been done about it.
There's a difficult, I guess, for a lot of these companies that are developing these games, that they've got to manage the expectations of their fan base. And a lot of what they're trying to do is they're trying to sell these games to these fan base, saying, yes, we're going to, why would you buy my game versus someone else's game? Because we're going to be providing X and Y, and we'll be doing all these different things in order to do that. So something like that in a sport game where rosters and player movements between teams is very important. And part of what people do is they not only simulate the season as it goes along, but they also go through and they will, you know, play them out exactly as is. They'll play matchups and things like that. You've got to try and maintain that on.
I think when your backbone is such a persistent world as the real life league, I think you need to have these updates come out when they're scheduled and when they're relevant, because otherwise then you just lose the key factor of why your game's good.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a sports game that you want to play real life people. Mm-hmm. So if it's not real life and up to date with real life, then you lose that, and I say it a lot, but that immersion, and that's what it's all about, you know. And that's why we were talking about 2K with their advertisements the other day.
Yeah,
that's why that game's just on the ball. They do it just like a basketball game. They have all the advertisements everywhere. They have all their rosters are like constantly updating, and that's why that game took over, because it used to be NBA Live was kind of the top, and then they switched over. And I mean, probably we could have done that years ago, but they just
there really are no excuses enough. Now, are there?
Like, there isn't. I mean, with the state of, I mean, that's like, yeah, 10 years ago, maybe. Maybe mm-hmm. you could excuse that kind of thing, but with the technology that's available to us today, there's no excuse.
And I guess it's not like these things are a surprise, like they're scheduled to happen.
They know they're coming. They know when the window's opening. And I'm no programmer, but surely like they could compensate for this,
but like
or allow for it.
Programmer or not, the game is promised that it would keep up with these things. It's a mechanic.
I'll tell you what,
though. Let down your fan base.
It depends on what you do. And often these things as well can come down to a money game. And when they're trying to play these games, it costs money to have someone sitting there making sure they're updating rosters. And it's probably not as simple as we think it is just to go through
and
do that.
But it should be. Put it this way.
Listen, developers, it should be easy. Just click a button and make it work.
Well, put it this way. I could have done all those transfers at home. Quicker than like much quicker than that,
and we
to
find
because it's not like it's an inability to do it within the game. It's something that you can do.
You
at
find
home,
there's a often
you shouldn't freaking have to
on a lot of these sports games. You do see a lot of people go, especially on PC versions, where they have a ability for people to go and update the rosters as they go.
Okay, so I'm a little confused. So
sorry.
this game. So usually when you play these sports games, you can make your own team. How does the roster coming out affect this mechanic?
Well, because these teams are based on real life teams, obviously, like all the soccer clubs throughout the world, down to the right player names, the right numbers, everything. It's supposed to be right, like real life.
Yeah. Okay. So these statistics.
Sorry, I'll just jump in. You don't necessarily you can create your own player and do like a career kind of mode thing, like with most of those sports type games. So it is about playing with real teams, and you might have your own player for you, but you don't have your own team. They're constitute real players.
Or sometimes you just slot into a real
team. Exactly, you slot in as a player.
Right,
Ronaldo's on the bench or something like
that. Yeah, Scott Quigg.
Sorry, David Beckham. Just take a break there.
Happens a lot.
It's interesting. Look, this is something that we've come across now because we've got an internet connected device, and if you were playing on the PlayStation era, no one expected the roster to be up to date. We just expected it from a certain point, and then we've gone from there. Is there a problem that, are we expecting too much from the people who are making these games? Something, for example, a game like from EA, one of the big EA games, has got a big company behind them, and they're making games from lots of stuff, and then there may be that company is...
Well, Pro Evo's Konami. Yeah. So it's not exactly a small company.
It's not a small company. Konami hasn't had a great couple of years, though. They've had a few...
No, they haven't. And this is just like a testament to that, which is just a sad... sad state of affairs.
I don't know. I think it's a difficult topic to come across, because when you've got these games, and if they've been sold as some particular thing and then they don't deliver on that, then that's sure. But I mean,
it's not just sport games. There's other
yeah,
games.
I mean, Pro Evolution Soccer is not a new franchise. It's not like they're just
I see it. That's the thing. I am a Pro Evo person. That's why I've been following it quite like intently. I've been playing Pro Evo for 10 plus years or something. I just prefer it to FIFA. I always have.
Yeah.
So I want them to be better.
Well,
because game wise, I think it is a better game. It's just as far as being an all rounded kind of supported game, EA are just killing them.
Well, something else that didn't really meet expectations, I thought personally, was Evolve when it came out.
Evolve?
Yeah, Evolve is the shooter, which is it relies on the unbalanced teams.
It's a spiritual successor to the Left 4 Dead franchise.
Yep.
So some of the team who were previously working at Valve have gone off and made this other game, and it is sort of it's kind of lopsided multiplayer.
Yeah, it's lopsided multiplayer is a better way to put it. But like for something based very heavily on your multiplayer system, in fact, there's no single player, it's just multiplayer. The way that you found your team and the way that you played with your friends, the game when you got into it was actually quite intuitive, but the way you found your game was just not on the ball. Yeah. Like it wasn't clear what exactly you were doing in each menu.
Yeah.
And it could have been easier to find your friends and find a game.
And I think the other big culprit for these games is any of the Peter Molyneux games where he hypes these things like crazy and will say you can do this, you can do that, you can plant a tree and it will grow in real life.
Peter Molyneux is now a verb.
Yeah, to Peter Molyneux something.
Yeah.
But even if you, speaking of evolving, if you remember the Spore game that came out, which was the, you know, the, I guess it's sort of like a sci-fi multi-stage sort of game.
Yeah.
When that came out, everyone was like, well, you know, Spore's going to be this huge next spiritual successor of The Sims, and it's going to be, you know, something like that. And when it came out, it sort of, you know, people's expectations weren't met. Whether that was to do with marketing budgets or maybe they didn't communicate to the audiences they should have done as they were going through the process. You know, it's a difficult kind of process to kind of go through.
Yeah. Like I said, it's they're not alone. There's plenty of other games that do it. It's just, I feel like if games are going to be of kind of like that stature, games of that stature, they need to, especially ones that are competing with such huge kind of franchises like FIFA, they need to be better.
Would you like to see game companies moving into, instead of having to long-term support these games, and I understand they want to sell their next roster of games as they go through, but would you like to see them open it up to the fans who are super passionate about it and get them to manage the rosters and maybe have like a mod website, which would be like, you know, subscribe to this RSS feed and then every new player roster we can come in here, or you can be like, well, we're going to play crazy leagues or whatever, and you could subscribe.
Yeah, okay, I like that. I like user-generated rosters.
Yeah, that way, if you put it from the outset, saying the company themselves, they're not going to be the ones that are going to be chasing after this because they're going to be moving on to the next thing. So they're going to give you the bare bones, and a lot of games, like once they've got the bare bones, you know, think of all your sandboxy games. As soon as people take those bare bones and turn them into something crazy, that they are better for it. So, I mean, would that be a better solution, do you think?
I mean, I can't say that it won't be because it does sound like it would be good. I mean, it's not without its risks and issues. But yeah, that sounds like a great idea. It would be nice.
All right. Well, let's get into the second part of our interview with Trent Custis. He talks all about Kickstarter and managing fan expectations. So we have a good chat with him about that.
That Kickstarter number, basically the 200K that we asked for, AUD, that just came from a bunch of research and then a bunch of maths, essentially, just crunching all of that down. So we're very big on process here at League of Geeks. I think a lot of indie studios just typically rush into things, you know, they're like, oh, I've got Game Maker or I've got Unity and I've got a friend who can code. And yeah, if we just try our hardest and we just make a game that is cool and all our friends like, and you know, feels really great, and I'll read up some articles on indie marketing and stuff, it'll all just work out, which is utter bullshit. So we're very, very process heavy and research heavy before we attack anything, whether it be Kickstarter, whether it be a marketing campaign, whether it be early access or full release, or even just speaking to a new platform holder like Valve or Sony or something like that. We go through at least a month of rigorous research and reaching out to other people who have had experience with the platform, both positive and negative, you know, experience with the platform. And then we basically form an attack plan and then we go about executing that. And that's what we did with Kickstarter. So I was already, I was fascinated with Kickstarter the moment it sort of, the gaming took off for it. And so I had a big spreadsheet where I was tracking the most successful Kickstarter campaigns and crunching all the numbers across, you know, what the average backer spend is and what the ratio of, you know, successes are and, you know, the number of comments for, you know, in comparison to the amount of money that they made and everything. So we knew a bunch of things, like that successful Kickstarters that tend to have a whole heap more money have higher number of comments, you know. So we kept our comments actively going. But that 200,000, really, you know, if we're talking about the number and just how we got there, that just came about by the fact that we knew that we were never gonna ask for, like, it's Kickstarter suicide to ask for less than the bare minimum that you need, you know, and just hoping that you'll get more. 305,000 AUD is what we ended up getting, and then we got, I think, 30K more or something like that in Slacker backers after that. But that's not even close to a third of our budget or a quarter of our budget. Like, the budget for Armello is over $1.5 million, really, when you count in-kind time and funding and our own personal investments of, you know, cold hard cash and savings. So, you know, it's, and this is a bit of the problem with Kickstarter as well, is that the perception of the public is, if you go and you start Googling about Armello and you start researching it, you say, oh, whoa, they made 300,000 on Kickstarter. Okay. And they got a bit of money from IndieFund, I see. And no one knows how much that is, you know, because it's not really, not public knowledge. And you start doing the math in your head of someone just looking at Armello, you think, oh, well, okay, maybe it's like a $300,000, $500,000 indie project. But really, it's three times that. And I think that's the case for every Kickstarter, really.
Is it something you'd think about doing in the future for other stuff that you'd be working on? Or is it now that you've kind of hit that point, you can go, well, we've got other ways of...
Yeah, that's, we would definitely, like, it always was a last resort for us before. Like, if we didn't get that Kickstarter money, we would have packed up the project, essentially. I think now that we have where we're at with the studio and the success we've had with Armello, we wouldn't just go back to Kickstarter because, hey, we were able to get a bunch of money from Kickstarter. Kickstarter's seen as, especially from people who haven't done it before, it's definitely seen as free money. So if you really wanted to be a jerk, as people have on Kickstarter, you can probably walk with the money, right? So people are like, oh yeah, there's not a bunch of stuff keeping you pinned down to it, and then you don't have a publisher and blah, blah, blah. But really, at the end of the day, you do. You have 6,000 publishers, and you have 6,000 separate individual expectations of what the end product is going to be. And then you have 6,000 people there before the product is finished. In our case, a year and a half before the product is finished. So, you know, especially if it's your studio's first game, that's a you have a community to manage. So we had a community manager on, like Lisa came on when she started as our community manager. We didn't even have a game that was released, you know? And so that all has a cost. And you slip up, and this is one of, there is an issue, there, well, there are a number of issues with Kickstarter, but one of the biggest ones is, you know, the perception thing, is what people expect from the project, and that it, Kickstarter promotes the ideal. It's like, give us money and we will make this. And it's like, okay, well, you got the money, why has it changed? And it's like, well, things change every day. And so we had some changes that came through our project. You know, that some of the community wasn't happy with, like a very small section of the community wasn't happy with, and that created hell, like, in our lives for, I don't know, like a couple of weeks. You know, it was just horrible. So there are things like that that you estimate, that's not because we really stuffed anything up beyond, you know, what any normal person or developer would be capable of. It was just normal course of development. And so we could do a project and plan everything out perfectly, and then 6 months into it, something shifts and you're like, oh, okay, well, now we're going to, which is a horrible feeling. We're going to upset a bunch of backers, but, you know, okay, now we've got to go to them and communicate why this is and blah, blah, blah.
So what are some of the biggest mistakes that you made that you suggest to other people not to kind of keep an eye out for or think very carefully about when they're doing something like this?
So, we have some very good friends at a number of studios around the world that have run big Kickstarters. And one of the big things that they said to us were like, stretch goals. Stretch goals will kill you. Watch your stretch goals. Like, don't even do them if you have the chance. But, you know, be careful about them. So we didn't do anything crazy like, hey, we'll come to Xbox and PS4 if we get $50,000 more or anything like that. But we still screwed up. Like, we said that we would do 12 languages and it just ended up being a crazy huge expense. And that wasn't just because we chose to do 12 languages. There are other, you know, decisions that we made along the way that helped that become such a big thing. But yeah, like, your stretch goals, and it's somewhere a lot of people email us or reach out to us for feedback on their Kickstarters. And that's one of the things that guaranteed in every email, like, why do you have this stretch goal? That's insanity. Like, think about, actually do the math on that. It's not possible. And it's not worth like hanging your studio for that. Just to get that extra bit of cash. I think another thing that we did is we had some exclusive content that was exclusive to backers, and it turned out that we just technically weren't even able to deliver on that. And so that's one of those things that, you know, you investigate it as much as you possibly can, and then you come back to it 6 months later when you reach that task and you're like, oh God, we can't even do that. Oh wow, okay. And so, you know, there's that's a big thing as well. So definitely be careful. It's just be careful what you're offering, you know, or what you're sort of committing to. And then I guess just, it's more like, I could rant all day on Kickstarter, like little tidbits of wisdom and everything. After doing that campaign running for 30 days and seeing so many different projects and talking to Kickstarter so much. But at the end of the day, it's all there. Like, the data is there. You can just data mine Kickstarter as a website. You can look at it, you can see what works, what doesn't work, you know, like just little things like having a video, how much more important that is. All of that stuff is so important. For the couple of mistakes that we made, you know, and that I can say like, hey, don't do this, there's a million more that you can definitely fall into. But I think the big one is that Kickstarter, like, just Kickstarter is not free money. And those 30 days, if you're doing a campaign properly, like if you're properly committed to running a successful campaign, like a big one, it's going to be the worst 30 days of your life, essentially. We called it the 30 days of despair, you know, because it's just this dark, this weird dark spell that you've just cast, or like, you know, that you're trying to control, and you don't know, you're putting things in but it's not reacting, then you're doing other things and it is reacting, and you have no idea how to tame this beast or, you know, what to do to make it work properly. And then at the end you're just like, you just get a bunch of money and then you have 6,000 people who are like, all right, I'm watching you. So don't go into it, you know, don't just think it's a thing where you, oh yeah, we'll just write up a campaign and then press the button and it'll just happen. It's like, it for us, it was about 6 to 12 months of like research and active prep, and then a month of dedicated full-time work, all of us on it, getting the campaign ready, and then 30 days of like average of 2 to 4 hours sleep a night. And then after that, obviously all the work that went into, you know, making the game and everything and managing the community.
That was Trent Custers. He's from League of Geeks. Their game is Armello. You can find it on all the websites. They're on at Armello Game and armello.com. Do yourself a favor and check them out. They are great people and they were very nice to chat to us during the week. That's all we got time for today. That's the end of our show. You can visit our website. It's www.radiomurdoch.com/pixelsift. Scott, where can people find us if they want to check us out on social media?
People, you all can find us at facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, and twitch.tv/pixelsift.
Which you may have been watching right now if you're looking at us online, looking at our lovely faces in our ghetto studio.
Oh.
And Mitch, if people want to have a look at previous episodes, well, I guess look at them and then click at them and then listen to them. Where are they going to go to?
All right, pretty much you can go check us out on Radio Murdoch page to stream episodes, or subscribe to our podcast on either Twitter, on iTunes, not Twitter, or use the RSS link on our page.
You can also go on Pocket Cast as well if you're on Android. That's an Australian company, so check them out as well. That's all we've got time for today, so we will see you again this time next week.
See ya.
For another episode of Pixel Sift.
Catch you later.
Bye.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.